I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 27th of August. Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States is our topic this hour, and Dr. Seth Holmes is our guest. The book is based on 5 years of research, and it documents migrant farm workers in the United States. To fully tell this story, Seth became a migrant worker, living and working on a berry farm in Washington State, spending a week homeless in Madera, California, with an extended migrant family of 23, finally securing a three-bedroom, one-bathroom slum apartment, and occasionally pruning grapevines. Living in poverty in Miguel, Mexico, and accompanying a group of 9 young men from San Miguel as they prepared to cross the border, trekked across the desert into Arizona, and were apprehended by the Border Patrol. These are documentations of people risking their lives, and Seth writes that crossing the border is not a choice to engage in a risk behavior, but rather a process necessary to survive, to make life less risky. He is an anthropologist and a physician, and is assistant professor of public health and medical anthropology at UC Berkeley. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave messages any of those ways. And our guest, Seth Holmes, is joining us from the studios of KQED in California. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
What a book you have written. It's just such an amazing story. And I realize the story that is missing when we talk about migrant workers, when we talk about border security, border crossings, et cetera, is the story of these workers. And God bless you for becoming one of them, but it was not a difficult thing it was not an easy thing to do, was it?
It was not always fun, but it was definitely worth it. Very interesting and very worthwhile.
Yeah. When you decided to do this kind of classic anthropological research method of participant observation, what made you decide you were going to do migrant workers?
I'd been very interested in all the conversations going on with politicians in the U.S. related to immigration, on and off debates about immigration reform, anti-immigrant sentiment in different parts of the country, and decided that I wanted to learn more about not only this group of people, but also what our country had to do with them.
Mm-hmm. And you actually decided that long-term immersion in the everyday lives of these people was the way to go. This involved a lot of hard physical labor on your part, but a lot of years of research. Why is this an important way of understanding the issues of immigration?
Great question. So as an anthropologist, I used the method of participant observation, which is different than most social science research. Most social scientists do observation either through surveys, through interviews, through tape recordings, etc. But as an anthropologist, I also, on top of observing what's going on, want to participate in the daily lives of what's going on in whatever phenomenon I'm studying, in this case, U.S.-Mexico migration. Part of the reason this is important is that without participating, there are many things I wouldn't have even been able to think of asking. Mm. There are a lot of things I learned about through sleeping in a labor camp, through picking strawberries, through looking for an apartment with people who don't have a credit history that I wouldn't have even thought to ask anyone about. I wouldn't have wondered very much about how hard it was to secure housing in the new places people go. I would have just sort of asked about the housing. And in the labor camp, one thing that I learned by living there that I wouldn't have learned otherwise is that in the fall during blueberry season, at night, the temperatures get below freezing. And then during the day, the temperatures get, you know, up into the 70s, maybe 80s again. Each shack that the people live in the labor camp has a tin roof. And during the night, as you breathe, your breath condenses underneath the tin roof. And then in the morning when the sun rises, all of that condensed breath over the night rains on you and everything that you have, which makes it hard to sleep and hard to kind of keep everything in order and keep everything safe and clean. But if I had just gone during the day and done interviews like a lot of other ways of doing research, I wouldn't have learned that.
Right. This is something that kind of haunts me, too, after reading a good portion of your book. The Catholic Church at the center of a border town in Mexico has hand-drawn posters along the inside walls, you write, facing the pews, describing the many dangers in crossing the border. Each poster asks in bold red letters in Spanish, "Is it worth risking your life?" That haunted you along the road here, didn't it?
That's correct. There were many posters. Some of them showed a drawing of someone dying of heat stroke under the sun. Some of them showed scorpions or rattlesnakes or assailants or robbers, all the different kind of primary dangers that people face in the borderlands. And then, like you said, it always ended with, "Is it worth risking your life?" And as I was experiencing a border crossing starting in Oaxaca in southern Mexico and ending in Arizona in the Border Patrol jail, I kept thinking about those posters over and over.
And what would your answer, how would your answer differ from those who you were traveling with? To them, it was a matter of really providing food, of making a living, right? So the risk, of course, would be something that would be worth it, even though the risks were enormous.
Right, correct. At first, when you think about that question, the obvious answer seems to be, yes, it's worth risking your life because so many thousands of people are attempting to cross the border each year. But at the same time, especially over this summer, this past summer, with all the debates in the Senate over immigration reform and the protection of the U.S. border, I realized that as an anthropologist, I needed to question that question itself.
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth risking your life? Presumes that it's experienced as a choice, that each person weighs pros and cons and decides, I'm going to take this course of action based on this. But when I did the research in crossing the border with people, in interviewing people who had crossed the border, none of them described it as a choice. None of them described thinking through pros and cons. They all described, as one of them is quoted in the book, saying, "There's no other option left for us." They described the last 10 to 20 years of being progressively impossible to survive in their home villages in Oaxaca. And through my research, one of the things that came up as a cause of this impossibility of survival in the home villages was international economic and political policies like the North American Free Trade Agreement. So the North American Free Trade Agreement caused signatory countries, Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, not to be able to have tariffs anymore on products coming from the other countries. But it still allows each country to subsidize their own products. And if we think about what a tariff is and what a subsidy is, they're essentially the same thing in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
So the more wealthy countries are able to subsidize their products and the poorer countries cannot. So in essence, this free trade is not very equal. It's a free trade that benefits the wealthier country. And in this case, the Oaxacan people who I was living with and migrating with had been farmers, corn farmers and bean farmers in their home ancestral lands. But since the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement, often called NAFTA, the U.S. has increased subsidies on corn by 300%, something that the Mexican government could not do. And during my research, I saw U.S.-grown corn, especially on large corporate agriculture farms in the Midwest, coming into the villages in southern Mexico and underselling the local farmers who were growing corn in their own towns.
So essentially, you have no choice but to come to the United States to do your farming.
Exactly. So you're forced to leave your own family farm, which is something that in the U.S., in the food movement, we are all supporting. Everyone pictures an idyllic family farm, and that's what a lot of these Oaxacan people had that we would want to support. But they had to leave their home farms for inability to make enough money to even buy the uniforms in order to go to the free public schools in their towns for their kids. And then they're forced to come to the U.S. to work on our farms, kind of in a wage labor, farm labor aspect, instead of being in charge of their own farm.
Is there anybody in the Mexican government, in the U.S. government, that's realizing what happened as a result of NAFTA, that we're putting people out of work, forcing them into poverty, and then forcing them into a system that we are saying is illegal, and these people are illegal aliens, and we've got to keep them out of this country or have them leave this country? And the whole thing seems to point to some policies that have created immense poverty and situations where people can't work. Somebody ought to be bringing that up to the highest levels of government, shouldn't they?
They should. That's a great question. There are voices. I've heard more voices from Mexico saying that NAFTA needs to be renegotiated so that people can stay in their homelands, in their ancestral lands, on their own farms. There are some voices in the U.S., including a lot of researchers, social scientists, economists who study immigration and farm labor, but the voices don't make it very well to the broad debates on immigration reform in the U.S. Most of what I've heard in immigration reform debates are very blanket statements about immigrants do this, immigrants don't deserve that, immigrants are illegal, quotes like that. But there aren't very many stories of individual human being immigrants who have had to make difficult treks, dangerous treks, whose children have had to give up schooling, etc., because of this background of NAFTA and other transnational economic policies.
So much of your story is quite dramatic, but let's go to April of 2004, where you accompanied a group of nine young tricky men from San Miguel as they prepared to cross the border. What do you do to cross the border? What preparations do you make? How you get there? And tell us more about, as you do so dramatically in the book, what the dangers are.
I'll start out by saying that in talking with a lot of the Triqui Oaxacan indigenous people, I realized that in order for me to understand the full course of their migration, I needed to do my best to cross the border with them. And I talked with a lot of people about the dangers ahead of time. I spoke with lawyers and other authors who had written about immigration, and I spoke with a lot of the Triqui people. I made plans with one particular border crossing guide, often termed Coyote, who was a Triqui man, about coming with him and his group across the border. And I arrived at his hut in their home village at the time that he told me to arrive in order to leave with him. And the hut was locked and everyone was gone. Mm. And I heard later that he had been worried that I was a Border Patrol spy or someone, a spy for the U.S. government, and decided that it wasn't worth taking the risk to let me cross with him. I ended up crossing later with people I had known in Washington State and Madera, the Central Valley of California, who knew me well and had come to learn that I was someone, you know, I was an anthropologist who wanted to experience their lives and live and write about their lives. So we left on a bus from a town very near their village. Every Saturday, a bus full of migrants who hope to cross the border leave. And the nuns from the village come each Saturday and pray for all the people who are leaving. We went into the that town's open-air market, and we bought slingshots. We bought snacks, mangoes and bananas and grasshoppers that had been fried, which is a common thing that's eaten in Oaxaca. And we got on the bus for close to, I believe it was 49 hours, something like that, bus ride.
Could you also talk about buying mayonnaise jars?
Right. So once we arrived in the border town, we were instructed by our coyote to buy mayonnaise jars to put the money, the cash that we had inside, so that if we were robbed, if assailants came upon us that they wouldn't be able to find the money that we needed to pay for our rides once we made it across the border, to pay the coyote once we made it across the border, etc. But interestingly to me, the whole town seemed to be set up for migrants, set up for border crossing, because every grocery store had aisles of small mayonnaise jars.
Oh my.
And every grocery store had aisles of Gatorade and Pedialyte and different sizes of water bottles. So it's very clear that a lot of people have to make this crossing part of their lives in order for them or their families to be able to continue surviving.
Mm-hmm. And it involves a long trek across a desert, doesn't it? It's hot.
Yes, it was very difficult. And I knew ahead of time, after talking with lawyers and doing research, that, of course, the border crossing was dangerous. But without experiencing it myself psychologically and physically, there wasn't a good way for me to know kind of in the depths of me how dangerous it was, how scary it was. You're hiking through the desert. We hiked starting at sunset and ending just after sunrise the next day. We went through a flat area of the desert, and we went with all relatively young, fit migrants. And so in some ways it was a ideal conditions under which I experienced a border crossing. But there were several times that we needed to stop because we ran into a rattlesnake, or we needed to stop because someone crashed into a cactus. Because if you're hiking through the night and you don't want to be seen, of course you can't use a flashlight or you can't use a headlamp. So we're trying to follow little paths and stay safe through it, but it's a very difficult process.
And you kill a rattlesnake with a slingshot?
I don't kill a rattlesnake
with
a slingshot.
No, I know you don't. I know. But the people you were with did.
Yes. So every once in a while, one of the people who I knew well, Macario, would pull out garlic and rub it on his shoes, and everyone would rub garlic on his shoes, and he told me that I needed to do that, and that that would scare away some of the rattlesnakes. I had also been instructed back in their home village to meet with a treaky healer, a traditional treaky healer, who would make from pine sap and coyote fur what they called a suerte, which literally in Spanish means a luck, but it's kind of a something that you keep in your pocket in order to kind of keep you safe. And there were several times during the border crossing that I would kind of hold on to that, hoping that the rattlesnake would, you know, stay quiet, or that the people we saw off in the distance were not assailants who were after us, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And the people you were trekking with had made this border crossing many times before, or was this their first time as well?
Two of them were on the younger side, somewhere in their mid-teens, and it was their first time crossing. One of them had, if I remember the story correctly, had sewn a hidden pocket in his pants to hide his money, but then apparently didn't have enough money in there to make the full crossing. So once we were actually apprehended, he had to go all the way back to Oaxaca for a time to make more money in order to try the crossing again. Everyone else had crossed several times before. And as you probably know, the border has become more and more difficult to cross, more and more dangerous to cross, through different border patrol policies and the ramping up of security on the border. So it used to be that these treaky people would come only for the summer to pick strawberries, and maybe the fall to pick blueberries, and then they would go home to be with their families, work in the cornfields, etc. But as the border has become more dangerous, it's also become more expensive to pay coyotes and people who will give you rides once you're across the border.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just simply more scary to cross, more physically risky.
Mm-hmm.
So since, you know, over the last maybe 10 years, more and more people have started settling in the U.S. Ironically, the ramping up of border protection to keep people out has actually caused a lot of people to stay in, because they can't go back and forth to be with their families and to be home.
So their families are left behind?
A lot of their families are left behind. The Treaky people, this indigenous native Mexican group, often cross the border with their family or with some of their family. So it's often husbands and wives, and maybe the older children will come to the U.S. The younger children will stay in Oaxaca, in their home village, to be taken care of by their grandparents or by their aunts and uncles, by extended family. So it's different than the braceros, or people who had been coming before the year 2000, when usually it was the men who came alone and women and children always stayed behind. So this native group often moves as family units together.
So, Seth, you make this long, arduous journey, very dangerous journey, only to be apprehended by the Border Patrol. I'm wondering about how everybody responded to that, and if your response was different. That must have been a horrible day.
Yeah, it was a horrible day. We arrived in Arizona, I remember, at one point while we were trekking, and we moved fast. I drank through a gallon of water every couple of few hours. We hiked as fast as we could over and under barbed wire fences. I had been a backpacking guide during graduate school and during medical school, and I was used to taking people on 12-day journeys through the mountains of California, but I had never hiked this fast or this nonstop before. Mm-hmm. Once we arrived in Arizona, as we were hiking, Marcardio told me, you know, we're in Arizona now. And I looked around me at the desert, and I couldn't tell any difference. It all looks the same. You know, borders don't necessarily fit with our geographical kind of realities. So once we were in Arizona, our coyote went to meet with one of his contacts to find out about when we could get a ride from there past the internal border checkpoint in Arizona, so that we could, you know, go to farms and start working. He was told by his contact that the Border Patrol had recently changed where they had kind of intensified the number of agents, and that area was more active now with Border Patrol agents, so that he wasn't giving rides anymore. So the coyote came back and told us all this. We're resting in a dry creek bed because we know that there won't be cactus spines inside the dry creek bed. And we're discussing the possibilities. Some of the people suggest that we hike somewhere else. Some of the people suggest that we pool our money, buy a car, that I drive the car past the Border Patrol checkpoint. I explain that that would be a felony for me, and that I wouldn't be allowed to work anymore, specifically as a physician. And they very much respect the need to work. So the coyote decides to go back to... it's actually a Native American reservation that we're right next to. He goes back to the reservation and asks around for another ride, finds another ride, all of a sudden jumps down into the dried up creek bed, speaking very quickly and tricky, and then two Border Patrol agents jump in after him, point guns at us, and in Spanish tell us to raise our hands. Mm.
At that point in the story, we will pause for a moment and welcome phone calls. What a dramatic story this is, isn't it? He is the author, Seth Holmes, of Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. He is now an anthropologist and physician and is a professor of public health and medical anthropology at the University of California in Berkeley. He says in order to ameliorate suffering and death in the borderlands, we must focus together on the legal and political apparatuses that produce labor migration in the first place. And it's his hope that those who hear his story will be moved in mutual humanity so that representations of and policies toward migrant laborers become more humane, just, and we welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Seth Holmes. He's author of Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. He realized that an ethnography of suffering and migration would be incomplete without witnessing firsthand what he calls an important site of suffering for Latin American migrants. And so this is a first-person account as well as an analysis of the economic reasons that this system is still in place. We welcome your phone calls. If you have questions about his remarkable journey or about immigration, about this kind of migration, about policies that keep this in, keep migration being an attractive alternative to people because, or perhaps the only alternative because they can no longer farm in the areas where they live. We welcome your thoughts. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You do cite some statistics, Dr. Holmes, about the number of people who have died in these border areas, and the numbers are really quite significant, aren't they? We don't hear that much about them.
That's correct. There was recently, this summer, a report released by the University of Arizona by National Immigration Institute or something like that. I don't remember the exact title, showing that the number of deaths on the border during crossing have been increasing over the last 20 years. And one of the arguments that I make in the book and that this report makes and several other people who study U.S.-Mexico borderlands make is that part of the reason people are dying in the border is the policy choice that the U.S. Border Patrol has made, specifically called prevention through deterrence. So prevention through deterrence is a policy that puts more Border Patrol agents and more kind of technology to stop border crossings in the safest areas of the border, some of which are near cities or towns. And then it leaves the more dangerous areas more free for crossing, in essence, encouraging the flow of migration into the most dangerous areas, partially in the explicit hope that people would be prevented from crossing through this danger, but also knowingly putting more people into more danger. So we know from this report this summer that more people are dying crossing the border despite the fact that less people are trying to cross. So it's actually a very increasingly extremely dangerous, but for some people necessary act in order for them or their families to continue.
How were you and your fellow people who were crossing the border treated by the Border Patrol?
It's a good question. I was treated as a confusing, outlying
I would imagine.
Person
who
should
guy?
Be sort of looked down on or reprimanded in a way. When the Border Patrol agents caught us, they told me, this doesn't look good for you with a bunch of illegals. And then they ended up calling in backup, and then that person called in backup to talk with me, to figure out what to do with me, because they hadn't seen what they called a USC, a United States citizen, crossing the border with Mexican people before. I had my passport, I had a letter from my university, I had a letter from my PhD advisor explaining what I was doing, what research I was doing. But all of this in some way made the kind of final backup person who came upset with me. He told me, how dare you break federal law for your thesis? Isn't this selfish of you to do this? And part of me inside thought, well, I had spoken with lawyers. I knew on some level what I was getting into. And I thought that this was really important for me and the United States and Mexico to understand more what's going on here. But you can't say that when you're under arrest. So my response was, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was interested in the fact that you couldn't get what was lawfully yours to be able to receive, and that was water and food every so many hours. You did not receive that, did you?
That's correct. There are certain laws that when you're in jail, when you're in Border Patrol jail, that you're supposed to get food and water and you're supposed to get a phone call within a certain number of hours. And many hours went by without anyone coming into the cell that I was being kept in. Interestingly, I was separated from the tricky people. They were all put in what is usually the men's cell, and I was put alone in the women's cell. And they did that, and they told me that I wasn't allowed to look at my tricky companions. They did that. One of them said because they were worried that I was a coyote. But I don't know how realistic that worry could be with letters from my university and a backpack that had anthropology textbooks in it. I don't think I looked like a very effective coyote. And in fact, I would have most likely died in the desert if I hadn't been with people who were kind of taking care of me. So there's not a very good sense in which I could have been aiding and abetting in any way. But in the women's jail cell, while I was waiting, every once in a while, I would motion kind of with my hand that I wanted to make a phone call. And the first two people, Border Patrol agents who saw me do that, just shook their heads and mouthed the word no. Until one Border Patrol agent came to me after all of them looked through my backpack. Something like 14 agents were looking through my backpack together. One of them brought my digital camera and asked me if they could turn on the camera. And I said, I want to call my lawyer. You can't turn on my camera until after I call my lawyer. So then they let me make a phone call. I called the lawyer in the Tucson area who I had made contact with ahead of time. She told me that there was a backlog in the courts and that it would probably be a month or more before I was able to make another phone call. So I gave her another friend's phone number who's a lawyer. I gave them my parents' phone number. And around that time, I started to cry, realizing that I was going to be stuck in a jail cell for a long time and without even a pen or paper to kind of take field notes as an anthropologist. And at that moment, my tricky friends were taken out in single file line to be deported back to Mexico. And the last thing they saw of me was me crying on the phone. Once I was taken back to my cell and the tricky people were gone, someone came and brought me these little juice container that I remember reading the label of, and it said contains 0% juice. So that was the drink that I was given after I requested my phone call.
Isn't it remarkable what you said a little while ago, that you probably would have died making that crossing if it had not been for those tricky companions that kept you alive?
It's true.
That's quite something, isn't it? The other part of the book looks at, you not only made this trek, which is obviously probably the more dramatic part of the story, but there's lots of drama and hardship in the migrant camps in the United States, trying to get health care in some months of the year, trying to find work. The living conditions are horrendous. And the work is arduous, isn't it?
It's very difficult work. I worked 1 to 2 days a week picking strawberries and then picking blueberries on the farm. And then in California, anytime we could get work on a vineyard pruning grapevines, I would work as well. But my tricky companions up in Washington State would work 7 days a week. So the days that I was not picking, I would do interviews of doctors and nurses who worked with migrant workers. I did interviews with public health officials, with farm owners, with farm neighbors, with supervisors, to try to get a sense of what one anthropologist, Laura Nader, calls a vertical slice, trying to understand kind of every level of a phenomenon instead of just one perspective or one position. But while I was picking, I remember thinking to myself, this is pure torture. The being bent over for hours and hours on end, my knees hurt, my hips hurt, my back hurt in such extreme ways that when I would stand up to take the strawberry buckets, the full strawberry buckets, to the people to be weighed, I would feel this sensation of a warm liquid running down my legs that felt sort of like blood running down my legs, which probably in a sense on the inside was what was happening after being bent over for so long. But like I said, my tricky companions were doing this every day, 7 days a week.
For how much money?
In Washington State, we were all paid at least minimum wage. So every farm worker was actually hired by the farm. So each of them got a paycheck every week or two, and everyone was paid minimum wage at least. We were actually paid 14 cents per pound of de-leafed ripe strawberries. And if you brought in strawberries that still had leaves on them or weren't quite ripe or were overripe, then you would get in trouble and you might not get paid for that, all of that weight. But interestingly, in California, there's a system, a contractor system that's in place so that the farms hire only one contractor to get the fields picked. And the only person who's on record for whom there's a paper trail is that contractor. Then the contractor will hire a lot of farm workers to do the picking, but none of those farm workers get official checks. They're all paid in cash. And every time we worked in California, we were always paid under minimum wage, I think largely because there wasn't a paper trail, so there couldn't be very much enforcement of labor laws that were in place.
And you spent, was it because work was hard to find? I know you spent with those you were working with at least a week in Madera, California, being homeless.
That was mostly because all of the apartments or houses that we tried to rent that looked nice, especially those that had big signs that said for rent, once we went and met with them, they would not rent to us because I was the only one with a credit history. I was the only one with a bank account, with a credit card, with a checking account. All of my tricky friends would make money, send some of that money via Western Union or something else to Oaxaca to their grandparents and their parents and relatives and maybe their kids if some of their kids had stayed behind. And then the rest of the money they kept in cash to use to pay rent, buy food, etc. So we ended up, after several days of looking for a place to rent, we ended up looking for the least hospitable looking places with the worst looking for rent signs, because we knew that the likelihood that they would rent to us was higher. So we actually kind of by necessity started looking for the slum apartments. And that's what ended up working. It took us a week sleeping out of our cars and using the city parks bathrooms during the day, looking back and forth across all the different street grid of the city in order to find an apartment that rented to us. And all of us moved into a 3-bedroom apartment with one family living in the living room. I actually lived in the closet because, kind of growing up the way I did in semi-urban, suburban Washington State, I needed a certain amount of privacy to stay sane. And they all were sort of embarrassed that I lived in this tiny closet, sleeping one corner to the other corner with my head on one side and my feet on the other side because it was so small. Whenever people would come over and visit and saw that I lived there, they would explain, you know, he's crazy. It was his choice. He could have had a full mattress if he lived in the living room, but for some reason he chose to live over there in that tiny closet. But I was glad that I, was the only person who had a door that could close so I could have some privacy to think, to write notes, to not be woken up by the little kids when they went to the bathroom in the middle of the night, etc.
We welcome phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Our guest this hour is the author of a really compelling book, important and captivating, a gripping read, according to Paul Farmer, and I would have to echo that. The book is Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. Seth is an anthropologist and a physician. He is a professor of public health and medical anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. And in order to understand the plight of migrant workers and migration policies and what it's like to cross the border and all of that, he decided that he would become a migrant worker himself and cross the border. And this book documents all of that, as well as looks at economic policies that keep this system in place and makes us question how we are treating migrant laborers in less than humane fashion. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Deborah in the UP. Hi, Deborah.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi. Our neighbor's daughter just came back from South America where she was teaching music, and now she just left 2 days ago for someplace in near Saudi Arabia. But I wrote a little poem for her, and it's like a minute long. You want to hear it? You'd find it interesting.
Okay, read as much as we can get to, Deborah. Okay. We're short on time.
Wherever you go, whatever you do, you're still the same person, still the same you. Travel the world and you will see new traditions, pain and poverty. The world you see changes the thoughts you own. What never changes is there's no place like home. And I wanted to ask him, this is just fascinating to me that you would do this. And I wondered why I thought of this idea. Why don't we set up shop? Why doesn't the U.S. set up shop in the West? And we could just do it on a trial basis and have immigrants from Mexico and South America work there and manufacture things in the U.S. instead of making things in China. So I'm interested if this is just too far, if this is not a rational idea or what you think.
Okay, thank you, Deborah. Seth,
good question and good poem. In some ways, I write some about some of the things that you said in your poem about the ways that these experiences have changed me, have changed the way that when I eat berries, what do I think about?
Right.
Can I just enjoy the berry, or am I aware of all the labor that goes in behind it and thinking about my friends, Marcelina, Marcardio, Samuel, who are picking berries? And so I appreciate those words. In terms of policies, projects, ways that this whole system could function better, I think it's very important for us to support immigration reform right now. I think it's important for senators, representatives in the House, especially since that's where it's stalled currently, to hear from their voters that we need comprehensive immigration reform that's fair, that takes into account all of the benefits, all of the positive things that immigrants do for us, especially when I think about the farm workers whom I have written about. Samuel, who I recently visited in Central California, for example, all the ways that they give of their own bodies, work so hard that their bodies become injured or become sick in order to give us the cheap fresh fruit and fresh vegetables that we need in order for the rest of us to be healthy, those of us who shop at grocery stores or farmers markets. It seems only fair that we would respond in a respectful way to their labor, to their presence, to their gifts to us by working towards immigration reform, including healthcare for these people who are giving of their own bodies in order for us to be healthy.
And yet we tend to treat these people, just by the phrases that we use, illegal aliens, we tend to treat them in a less than human fashion. And that was true of the Border Patrol, and it's true of many of our encounters and our descriptions of migrant workers. I don't fully understand where that comes from.
Very true, Kathleen. As an anthropologist, I'm very interested in the interplay between structures, in essence, hierarchies of different kinds of people, policies that create boundaries that put people in certain positions. That's what we would refer to as social structures, and then symbols. And you're bringing up some of the symbols, the words illegal, the word alien, the word criminal, some of these things that have been used in immigration debates that have led to very anti-immigrant, in some ways inhumane policies being passed. There are ways in which the structures of hierarchies lead to negative symbols of the people who are lower down in that structure, in that hierarchy. And there are ways that those symbols, the words illegal and alien, lead to a kind of fear and a certain kind of voting that then reinforces those structures that are unequal in the first place. So I think it's very important for all of us to be thinking about how can we work to change both the structure and the symbol, because they reinforce one another, they reproduce one another.
Barb in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm so happy to see that you have this program. I personally worked for about 5 months a year with a humanitarian group called Samaritans in southern Arizona. And Seth, I know right where you probably crossed and came in. I applaud what you've done and that you're bringing it to light. Could you address, if you know anything about it, because I work in a coalition of people down there, the deterrence program that was started during the Bush administration, which is called Operation Streamline, the federal court system where we shackle and handcuff people, drag them into court every day of the week. There's like 70 in the Tucson sector that are chosen. They've had no showers. The courtroom just reeks, and people are treated just, it's embarrassing that I live in a country that would treat people like this. Do you know about that program, and could you address that, please?
I know some about that program, and I've worked with Samaritans as well, and No More Deaths and Humane Borders, a lot of the groups that are down in the Tucson sector, which are doing important humanitarian work. In terms of your specific question, after my border crossing, I did interviews with Border Patrol activists, Border Patrol agents, some vigilantes, and looked into what was going on in the area, what people were thinking about. I don't know specifically, I didn't do research specifically on Operation Streamline, but I have looked into the ways in which Mexican migrants in the U.S. are understood and thought about in the courtroom. There's a very compelling piece written by another anthropologist whose name is Lachlan Jain, J-A-I-N, about the ways in which Mexican migrants in the courtroom have been treated as not human, and the ways in which jurors have understood them not to be fully human in the same way that they understand themselves to be, and how that relates to the courtroom decisions that are made. But that's not something specific. That project is not something specific that I look into in the book.
Thank you, Barb. Monica in Greenfield. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call and for this program and for your courage. I'm calling. This reminds me of a couple of two movies, and I have two questions. The first movie was Jurassic Park, and in there they say that life finds a way. And I think it's very important for all of us to understand we will not understand and solve the immigration problem, illegal immigration, until we understand that these people don't leave their homes and families and children because they want more money or a TV or a car. They do it because they have to provide, and there are many times no ways of providing. And that's where my first question comes. When are we going to see them as people that are looking for economic and health asylum?
Seth.
Very good question. I agree with you. This summer I wrote a piece that was in New America Media and Salon.com specifically about a lot of these tricky people actually don't want to leave their homes. They don't want to become U.S. citizens. They don't want the American dream the way that a lot of us in the U.S. imagine. A lot of them would prefer to work on their own farms, in their hometowns, be with their relatives, be in their ancestral lands. But as the caller said, they don't have another choice in order to live. They have to make this cross, go, through the dangerous border to work on our farms. And one of the things I try to do in the book is tell the story of particular people mm-hmm. who have become friends of mine, companions, so that the immigration debate for the people who read this book will be less about immigrants as a blanket statement, as a stereotype, and more about individual people who are brothers and sisters and daughters and parents and human beings just the way we are.
Thank you, Monica, so much for your call. Seth, thank you so much for having written this. It's so... it's such an important thing to have done. I know it was terribly risky, and your mom must have been so... so afraid every moment you were doing this, but it's important. You must know that on a deep level, huh?
Interestingly, Kathleen, my mom is here with me.
Is she really?
Yep, in the engineer's booth.
That's great. Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom. I called her from the border town and told her that we were about to cross, and she understood why it was important and said, just call me as soon as you're somewhere safe. Mm. There is a way that this was risky for me, but it's not the same as the risk that the migrant workers take on where this is their life. Yeah. I did this for 18 months full time, followed by several years of follow-up visits.
But you did it for us, too. The book is Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. The author is Seth Holmes. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. We have another hour to go.